All right, so it's been about 65 hours now since the Luka and AD trade was announced late Saturday night, and it still makes no sense at all. Actually makes less sense than it did on Saturday night, because at least when I first heard about it, after I had figured out that it wasn't, some fake April Fool's joke or somebody hacking into Shams' account on Twitter. Once I realized that, my first thought was, okay, well, Luka or AD or both must have wanted this deal to be made. One of like they must have forced this to happen. In this player empowerment era, we rarely see stars traded, at all, other than when they are the ones that are forcing their way to a specific team in a lot of cases, honestly. AD was one of the pioneers of that in the more recent era of the NBA. But yeah, since the time has passed, since the deal has been made, we have learned that that is not even the case. Neither of these players even knew, supposedly, that this trade was in the works at all or even a possibility. The rest of the league had no idea. Apparently, all the other GMs across the NBA are pretty mad, understandably, that they did not know. They were completely unaware that Luka Doncic was available to be traded. I don't even really think AD was very available to be traded. There was some talk of AD being moved, but that people were looking at that as like, oh wow, that's a crazy idea. That'll probably not happen. But it was just like a fun thought experiment to think about, oh, what could the Lakers do if they trade AD? Maybe. Little did anybody know that he would be moved, and it would be for Luka Doncic, who obviously is on no one's radar to ever be traded because he's one of the most untradeable assets in the league. Literally, him, Jokic, and Victor Wembanyama. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, that's probably the top four right there. Like, that's a play, it's a non-starter in a conversation about a trade, but yet the Mavs offered this to the Lakers. That's the reporting around it, anyways. A couple weeks ago, apparently the Mavs reached out to the Lakers about this. And so I'm still like, there's so many details, so many things about this that is so wacky and confusing. But one thought that I've had is like looking at the return that the Mavs did get for Luka Doncic. They got Anthony Davis, Max Christie, and a first round pick from the Lakers in 2029. And they gave up Luka Doncic, Maxi Kleber, and Markieff Morris, I believe. And so looking at that, I just don't understand how, like, in an era where anytime there's a trade, even for not really a star, there's picks being swapped, there's actual pick swaps being exchanged, there's this deal is completely void of that. I just don't understand how you move one of the most valuable, contracts in the league. You move that for one that is in an entire class below that, which like as the classes escalate in terms of player contracts at the very top, the gap gets immensely wider. Like it's so much, there's so much of a gap between the class of player that Luka is in terms of his value as a contract because of his age and potential and what he can do on the court and team roster construction, all those things. There's such a wide gap between him, the class of player he is, and where AD is, which is really the next class below, but still, that's what I'm saying, is that's how big there's a gap between those two classes of player. AD is like the 10 to 15th most valuable contract in the NBA, probably. Luka is the third, maybe second, maybe, who knows, maybe first. Victor Wembanyama isn't the like absolute surest thing. I'll probably put Victor first, though. I'll concede that point. But still, this is just absolute insanity. I don't understand it. I don't know how somebody can convince themselves to make this kind of move. I don't care about his conditioning. You know, it's, he could have been doing so many, he could have been on hard drugs. He's made 5 first team All-NBAs in his 6-year career. He's 25 years old. He elevates his play in the playoffs. He controls at the ends of games in the playoffs. You give him all of the money that you possibly are allowed. Like, no questions asked at all. The rumor going around is that the new owners or somebody in the Mavs circle doesn't want to pay Luka that Supermax deal here in a couple summers. It's like, you know, these owners are new, but that's very much a part of being a basketball owner. There's some players alive that deserve a Supermax deal because that's the top of the spectrum. It's a grading scale. So there's got to be some people in the highest elite class of players, right? Luka Doncic is unarguably in the very middle inner circle, you know, of that tier. If you're not going to give Luka Doncic the Supermax, who will you give the Supermax to? And I understand the health concerns somewhat, that it's like makes it maybe a little bit more shaky than like a Jokic, you know, but still the way that Nico Harrison and the Mavs front office have talked about this trade in the aftermath and for their reasonings of doing it, they're talking about Luka like he's Zion, you know, or Joel Embiid even. You know, Zion's probably the worst example of that, but like, Luka's not either of them. He's not the most healthy. He's not always available, but he's sure as hell on a completely different level than those other guys who get paid Supermax money and their teams have not traded them, you know? And on top of that, he's also proven what he can do in the playoffs, even though he's struggled with injuries here and there. You know, Joel and Zion, for that matter, we haven't seen Zion play a literal playoff game. He's not played in a playoff game. Joel Embiid has had a very, very checkered, mostly negative playoff track record. And, you know, and he's been injured for a lot of it, but he's played through the injuries and whatnot, which same for Luka. Luka's been injured, struggling with some kind of injury, like literally every single playoff run he's been in. He's had something that's been hampering him, that he's been nursing along, playing through. And he's still one of the best players on the, like literally the top 3 or 4 best player in the postseason, probably even higher than that, at least 3rd, since he's been in the league. So I don't understand. I just don't understand. I think he's probably 2nd, actually, for what I was just saying, the best players in the playoffs since he's come into the NBA. I think he is 2nd, behind only Nikola Jokic. I would definitely put him above Giannis, to be honest. Giannis has had some major flops. Wow. I'm sorry, I still can't believe this, but this is a recording that I'm doing for an intro on a podcast episode that I already have recorded. So there's that. This isn't going to be super long. This was just wanting to acknowledge the insanity that has taken place in the NBA world and just the world in general. I feel like the entire earth became about this for the past like day or two. At least everything that I've interacted with, this has been a part of it in some way. I feel like this has not left my mind since it happened. I was out door dashing on Saturday night when this news came out. I got a text, actually, in a group text with my co-host, Jacob Roth, and another one of our friends. And our friend said, "Ain't no way the Mavs just traded Luka for AD." And I opened that, looked at it, and like didn't even consider the possibility of that being true. My mind went straight to, okay, this is a prank. Like, he's obviously just saying something. And that, but my, you know, with that even, I was like, this is just such a dumb trick because it's not even like believable. Like, why would he not say something that's crazy but believable? This isn't believable. I was like, never in a million years. So I was like, this isn't, I was about to say, yeah, ain't no way they did that because they did not do that. There's no way they did that type of thing because they definitely did not. But then for a second, I just thought, huh, but this, it just doesn't feel like he is pranking us because I know this, you know, this is my friend. He wouldn't say something so, like, this isn't something he would come up with to prank us with. You know, it just feels like he would want to use something that's more believable. So that, you know, this reverse psychology type thing started confusing me. And so then I went and just looked at Twitter just to check to see if, oh, maybe there's like something fake going around that he saw, you know, and maybe believed. Or he saw and then is trying to get us to see if we can believe it by, you know, saying it's real type thing. And so I went looking for that. I didn't see anything for the first couple minutes that I opened Twitter. Didn't see anything at all. And then I just went to Shams' page because I was like, if it's going to come from somewhere and it's real, it's going to come from Shams. So I looked that up and there it is. The very most recent tweet, like literally a minute, 2 minutes before I looked at it, it was posted. And obviously in the replies, everybody was thinking he got hacked. And so then I was still under the assumption that like something weird is going on, what's happening right now. A lot of people even like looking at the details of the trade were like, you know, if you wanted to make a fake Luka for AD trade, it wouldn't look like this. Like you should have thrown in like, you know, pick swaps and, you know, more draft capital, more young players. Like they should have gotten at least Austin Reeves or Dalton Connect or, you know, something like that. But no, it was real. And Shams had to quote tweet his original tweet saying, no, this is real. And then, you know, people still thought maybe the hacker is still, you know, logged into Shams' account. And so then Bobby Marks, I believe, another ESPN NBA insider, had to quote tweet that tweet again, saying, no, this is like actually real. This is really happening. And it wasn't until that I was like, oh, all right, this is legit. This is legit. It's just insane to me. You never trade Luka Doncic. You don't, like, maybe if he was 31 like AD is and somehow has not won a title yet or an MVP or anything in this thought experiment and still only has, you know, 5 first team all NBAs or whatever and has just been struggling to stay up, then maybe you make a deal like this. But right, he's 25 years old and he just took your team to the finals after missing the playoffs the year before and also being a like terrible defensive team for the first half of that season last year. Like you built a competent defense around him and like it became one of the best defenses in the league. And Luka became your offensive engine just on the other end, you know, with Kyrie supplementing. And it's like, that was a good formula. It was a terrible matchup going against the buzzsaw of the Celtics, but you made it all the way through the Western Conference. And your star player is only 25 and wants to be there. He cried, apparently, when he found out about the trade. He had just bought a $15 million house in your city. A week before this, he closed on that house. He had no idea this was coming. He said after the trade, after finding out, he thought that he would be in Dallas his entire career. Your fans... There's not a like, there's barely any other player to fan base relationship as special as this one. Your fans all get like rally around him as the face of your franchise, of like the next Dirk. And you trade him when you don't need to at all. And the other part of this is, even if you were to be a completely dumb person, if you just wanted to be dumb, let's say that. Do make one dumb mistake in that you're entertaining the idea of trading Luka because you don't like that he can't stay healthy and you just want something more consistent, like AD, you know, the complete picture of health, which is just another ironic thing about this. But let's say that you've talked yourself into trying to trade Luka. Why would you make a secret deal in the middle of the night, only talk to one team about it? Like, you're only going and talking to one team. Obviously not bartering all that hard, because I cannot imagine Rob Pelinka having the balls to be like, you're asking for both of our firsts down the line. No, I'm actually going to take one of those out of there and, you know, like, negotiate it. Like, I could not believe doing that when you're being offered Luka Doncic in a trade. Like, I would be like, yep. Like, I would be so afraid of losing this offer and having them take, the discussion to another team to see if they can get somebody better. I would just say yes to whatever they were offering me in this situation, especially when it's that little. It's just insane to me. How does that happen? I don't even remember where I was when I started it. I feel like I started leading into a point that I was making. But yeah, let's say that you're dumb enough to convince yourself to try to trade Luka. Why would you make a secret deal with just one team instead of shopping them around? Like, you should announce to the world that this person is available, so you can get an insane amount of value. You can start a bidding war. It would be the biggest haul of any player, like any trade for a star in NBA history. This would be, if you properly went around, like, went about that process, like every other star that's been traded has gone through that process. I don't understand. I don't know if it's Nico Harrison was afraid of, you know, in this player empowerment era, when players decide, like, oh, it's time for us to part ways, me and my team, then they, like, they get all the control. You know, they decide where they want to go, basically, by publicly doing all these things. I don't know if he was afraid of Luka finding out about their ideas to trade him because they didn't want him to get any leverage. But it's like, the reason why you don't want to let him get leverage is so he can't milk, you know, can't force his way somewhere and take your leverage away from other teams. And therefore you end up with a dampened return. Your return is not as potent as it could be. If that's what you're afraid of, you literally just did that worse to yourself than if you shopped him, even if he made a big fuss about it, it became a drama like the Jimmy Butler situation right now. Even if it became like that, you would still be able to get more value than this. And that is why literally the leading theory in my mind right now, the thing that can explain this, the only way I can see this explained in a way that makes some sense, is that the NBA manufactured this in some way. Like, they made this deal happen because the Lakers are their golden child. That's like their cash cow, you know, that's globally, that's the biggest brand in sports, really. Every, like, basketball fan around the world, like every country, probably the leading team in popularity, other than maybe Serbia, I guess, and Greece, I don't know, like a couple of countries here and there. It's the Lakers. Like, those are the favorite teams. That's the favorite team of, like, literally every country across the world. So that's, you know, how big of a brand it is. And they're maybe afraid of, oh, this Luka and AD era. They're kind of stuck in the middle. They don't have a great team around those guys, and those guys aren't young enough or, you know, at their peaks enough to carry it to absolute, you know, mountaintop. And also the league is just at a way more competitive level than it has been throughout history, that just having two top 10 guys doesn't make you an automatic top 4 or 5 team in the NBA because of how much parity there is. And so, you know, they look at that and they think, well, the Lakers, just like several times in history, they need to they need to luck out and find their next phase. They're find their next face of the franchise, their next era of Lakers stardom, of Lakers dynasty, if you will, really. And like, who's if you're going to pick from a hat, not pick from a hat, but pick literally any player in the league to be like, okay, this, yeah, moving forward, somebody to usher in the new era after LeBron, you know, to make that seamless transition, become the next face. This literally is the first pick in the NBA for that because of how similar he is to LeBron and his start and the, like his brand and his stardom. Like that's so perfect. Victor would probably be the other pick just based off of a pure basketball talent standpoint. But Luka is oftentimes compared to LeBron, you know, it's like one of his biggest player comparisons. LeBron was his childhood icon. So that just makes sense, obviously, that you would get Luka to the Lakers just so like just as their the most recent superstar, super duper star that basically just falls into the Lakers' lap. It happened first back in the late 60s, I believe, early 70s, somewhere in there. I think it was late 60s with Wilt Chamberlain ending up there in Los Angeles. Then it happened again with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in the 70s, and then again with Shaq in the 90s. And then honestly, even with Pau Gasol, when the Lakers were a not very good team, you know, they were struggling with just having Kobe as their only real star on the team and not a lot around him. And then, you know, somehow the Lakers pull off of a eerily similar trade to this at a much smaller scale. Because Pau Gasol was like, you know, a top 10 player in the NBA, not top three. And 10 was on the higher end, I feel like, probably. But he's probably around there. But the Lakers were able to pull off this deal to snag Pau Gasol out of Memphis. And the reaction afterwards from all the other teams was like, when did this happen? Like, we didn't know that Pau Gasol was available. How did the Lakers just get Pau Gasol for not very much? It's very similar to this. It's like the NBA orchestrating things to be like, all right, the Lakers need a little juice. They need a little something. This is more than a little juice. This is like league, not even league, like sports world defining type of, you know, it changes like the effects of sports on the world, not just like sports. You get what I mean? Like this is that big of a deal. Which you could argue Pau Gasol to the Lakers did that a little bit because, you know, the Lakers won the title twice. After that, and they wouldn't have if they wouldn't have gotten Gasol. But this is even to a more insane extent than that. This makes that look like child's play. Like, I don't know how else to explain this other than it's either that the league paid like an exorbitant amount of money to the new Dallas ownership group and said, we're going to get Luka. We're going to take him from the Mavericks and we're going to give you AD. And we're going to put Luka in Los Angeles because that's just better for the league as a whole. We'll all make more money, trust me. And we will directly pay you, you know, as if you still have Luka, essentially. You know, you're not going to lose out on all those jersey sales. You're not going to lose out on all those playoff tickets, seats, you know, being sold, all of those things. We're going to get you some compensation so we can all make some more money here by putting Luka, optimizing his brand, putting him in L.A., and optimizing the Lakers brand moving forward because they'll still be relevant after LeBron's done. Like, I just feel like if the league was capable of making that happen, wouldn't they? Wouldn't they do that? Wouldn't they want to do that? At least. And it's like, that is a pretty solid explanation for all of this. It seems like it's either that or Nico Harrison is just off the henny. He's going through something right now. Probably he needs to be checked into an insane asylum. Like he is just a madman. Like a 9-year-old running an NBA team. You know, he's either completely lost his mind or he has always been mentally inadequate to do this sort of job. But somehow has failed his way into, you know, he's been a broken clock. That's right. Almost every single time so far, because all the moves he's made have been pretty good looking back on them, even though like, especially the Kyrie one, I did not like it at the time. A lot of people didn't like it at the time. It worked out. I don't know if I defend it like, I would still probably, in retrospect, like, look back at it, say, overall, they're pretty lucky that it panned out the way that it did. But, yeah, it, I don't know. It's probably breaks even there. It's like, either way. It's not, it was not a bad thing to not make that deal, but making it, there's, you know, there's a lot of upside to be had there. And we've seen that payoff. So, yeah, it's either Nico Harrison has no idea what he's doing, and it's just coming out now. It's just finally starting to show itself. Or that the NBA has orchestrated this. Those are the only two theories I have. unless there's something really crazy that Luka had going on health-wise that they found in some sort of physical examination. But that would also be against the rules, because you can't hide. Like, if it's something that would be able to be found in procedural physical exams, then the Lakers would have caught it, obviously, before the deal goes through. But even if they do find something, do you say no? Do you just say no? Take Luka Doncic back? Like, that's what's so crazy about this. It's like, even if he has some questionable health concerns or conditioning concerns, he's Luka Doncic, and he's accomplished all of this already with those things, really. So it has to be something that's a new problem. If there is some sort of problem that motivated them to do this. Because I'm not buying Nico Harrison saying, oh, we really want defense. Defense wins championships, and we want to get a great defensive player in Anthony Davis. It's like he's not going to be getting any better at defense moving forward. I mean, he's 31 years old, and he's going to be also your best player on offense probably, unless Kyrie. I mean, it's going to be him or Kyrie on offense most of the time, you know, obviously. And, like, are you you're a better defense? Yeah, probably. Yes, you are a better defense. But at what cost? At what cost? Once you had your team fully realized, you know, after the trade deadline last season, is this all because they let Derrick Jones go? If they didn't let him go in the offseason, would the Mavs still have Luka Doncic? Because if we're going to buy Nico Harrison's explanation that their defense isn't good enough, a big part of why their defense is not as good as their top three in the league defense that they had last year entering the playoffs is because Derrick Jones isn't there, to be quite honest. And there was not a real reason they let him go for pretty cheap and opted to sign Klay Thompson. I don't think that's the reason why we're at this point, but I'm just entertaining that based off of what Nico has said. I just can't believe it. I'll end this intro here. It's been quite a while, pretty long one. I'll end it just by saying this. I would have never guessed in a million years that Dwight Powell was going to, you know, be on the Dallas Mavericks before Luka Doncic got to Dallas, and that Dwight Powell would still be on the Dallas Mavericks after Luka Doncic was no longer there. After Luka's tenure in Dallas had ended, Dwight Powell is still on the team. Obviously, that's not the important detail about all of this, but just something to for your brain to chew on. Dwight Powell was the longest tenured Maverick, and he has continued to be the longest tenured Maverick. Luka will never pass him. Luka's not ever going to pass him. I thought that was, it's just funny looking back, because at one point I was doing an episode or a video or something looking at the most tenured player that's been there the longest on each NBA team, and all of them was like their star, you know? Nuggets is Jokic, the Lakers is LeBron, so on and so forth. And then you look at Dallas, and it was Dwight Powell. He's just somehow been able to stick around, like, all these years, since 2014 or whatever he's been here since. But just looking at that, I in my mind, I think, oh, yeah, that's weird. That's funny right now. But obviously, sometime soon, that's going to be Luka. Nope, that will never happen. That day will never come. And that's just sad. I'm not a Mavericks fan, but I feel bad. Like, my heart hurts, to be honest. Like, this made me sad, this move. Because I'm like, how can you be so out of touch with your community, your fan base, you know, the people that give you the platform, the job that you have, the position that you're in. And like, I'm just removing the basketball from the conversation, which is, it's like, also when you just look at the basketball of it, never make this move. That's dumb. Don't do it. But also when you think about culture, fan base, you know, community, like those things are, they'll never be the same. You affected an entire market, an entire, you know, community in a way that is irreparable. Like, it's just true. I mean, obviously, there's still going to be Mavericks fans in 5 years. You know, a lot of them, there will be people that have gotten over it, for sure. But there's also lines of fans that have been cut off, and they're never going to come back. Like, that's just a fact. And that's just crazy. It's just wild to me that there's not even a good reason for it. And you're still willing to cause all that harm. Oh. But yeah, hopefully we'll get Jacob back in the fold soon so we can get his thoughts on that. Obviously there have been other trades, seeing as it's deadline week. Like Fox and Levine and all. I'm not going to talk about any of it because I just wanted to acknowledge this here at the top. Thank you for listening. Please enjoy the episode. I'm going over my sub all-star teams. Have fun with that. Hello and welcome to the Derrick Rose episode of the Hoop Theory Podcast, aka episode 108, which is in honor of him being the first pick in the 08 NBA draft. Recording this one on the afternoon of Friday, January 31st. My name is Logan Wertman, and unlike usual, I am actually not joined by my co-host in Jacob Roth this week. He's actually gotten really busy, way busier, believe it or not, since he's had his third kid. So, you know, that was the result, or the source rather, of the hiatus in the first place. So moving forward, for me to keep getting, you know, Hoop Theory episodes out, I'll probably just have to fly solo every once in a while here and there. So we'll try to do that here today. It's been a long time since I've recorded a solo episode, but we're going to try to tackle that right now. So it's going to be about all-star teams, but a little bit of a different spin on it that I had an idea to do this year, called sub all-star teams. You might have heard of Thinking Basketball doing a version of this in the past. I don't know if they still do this, but Thinking Basketball used to do this thing back in the day called sub all-star teams, or just sub all-stars rather. I think it was basically just a list of them. There was no like limit on making a team. And it was also like more of a view of like, it's a role player, you know, like really good role players, good players that are good at not being all-stars, basically, is what the idea or the vision behind it was. This one that I'm doing today is actually literally just like make two all-star teams for both the East and Western Conference, you know, but just cut out all of the people who made the actual all-star teams from the NBA, like basically like act like they don't exist, you know, they're erased from existence. And so now what would the all-star teams be if all of them got injured? We'll phrase it that way. If the whole all-star teams got injured, what would the new all-star teams look like? So that's the exercise I wanted to tackle here today. But before we get into any of that, I'd first like to thank everybody for listening. The bench just got announced last night for the all-star team also. So this is pretty fresh. I'm recording this on Friday, January 31st, as I said before. But yeah, thank you everybody for listening. I'd like to suggest to everybody to hit us up on Patreon if you want to support the show, or buy me a coffee as well. That's the other website you can go do that at. That's patreon.com/hooptheory and buymeacoffee.com/hooptheory. All of our links can also be found in the description of both the show and the episode, wherever you're watching or listening to this. We would also greatly appreciate it if you would rate the show, leave a like or a comment. Of course, be sure to subscribe and follow the feed And lastly, we'd also love it if you sent something into our mailbag for us to read and react to. Basketball related or otherwise, you can send those over to hooptheory.mailbag@gmail.com. And without further ado, let's get into today's episode. So the All-Star teams just got announced yesterday, like I was saying before. Well, the starters had been announced for a couple weeks now, something like that, it feels like at least. That's in the East, Giannis, Jalen Brunson. I don't know why they do it in this order. I think that's kind of dumb. Jalen Brunson and Donovan Mitchell are the guards. Giannis is the first forward. Tatum, I'm guessing, is the second. I think he is. Pretty sure he finished second in voting. And then Karl-Anthony Towns is the third forward. I don't know why they don't list it in terms of, you know, the top vote getters in each position, but I don't even see a pattern, honestly, in how they're... Because Tatum, yeah, it's not even alphabetical. Unless it's by first... It is by first name. Usually, when they do alphabetical, it's by last name. But no, the reserves aren't in alphabetical order by first name, though. So I have no idea. I have no idea what NBA.com is doing. But yeah, to repeat that, though, Jalen Brunson, Donovan Mitchell, Giannis Antetokounmpo, Jason Tatum, and Karl-Anthony Towns are the starters out East. For those of you who aren't watching the video version, I feel like I just need to repeat those things because you can't see what's on the screen. I've got a screen recorder in front of me for people enjoying the video version. But the reserves in the East, we've got Jaylen Brown as the first guy listed on NBA.com, at least. You can't, I don't know. I tried looking yesterday for the coaches' voting results because the, you know, the whole bench on each of the All-Star teams are chosen by the coaches voting. And I don't even know if they do just the the Eastern Conference coaches pick the East and vice versa for the West. I'm not sure if they do it that way or not. But yeah, that's the way they pick them. And with all the other voting things in the NBA, they publicly release, you know, the results. And you can see how many votes people got, but I haven't been able to find it for the coaches voting for the bench to see how close some of the snubs were. But anyways, back to the reserves out East. There's Jaylen Brown, Darius Garland, Evan Mobley, Tyler Hero, Pascal Siakam, Cade Cunningham, and Damian Lillard. And I had my All-Star teams mapped out because originally I was going to record this episode before they were actually announced, and I was building the All-Star team as well. The East was pretty good. I actually had the same exact starters, and I think even the order as well, because Jalen Brunson and Mitchell were the top two guards in that order. And same for the forwards, their front court spots, rather. And then in the reserves, the only thing I have different is I didn't have Tyler Hero in. He was very close to getting on one of the next names I had, but the person I had in there over him was Trae Young. And then the coach is Kenny Atkinson. I don't know if that matters all that much. It's just that's the team that has the best record in the conference, the Cleveland Cavaliers. Western Conference, though, Steph, KD, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, LeBron James, and Nikola Jokic are the starters. So to do that in order, correct order again, Shai is by far the number one guard. Then Steph would be second. And so those are the two guards in the starting lineup. And we've got Jokic in the front court. KD is another front court guy. And then LeBron is the other one. So this is what I had different from what the actual results were. In the starters at West, I didn't have KD or LeBron. I did have Steph in the backcourt with Shai, although it was very close between him and Anthony Edwards for me. But yeah, Jokic was by far the number one front court spot, and Shai by far the number one guard spot. They're the two best players in the NBA this season, the two MVP candidates. So makes sense there. But then, yeah, these wings is where I really didn't agree with what actually happened. And oh yeah. Okay. So the two guys I did have in there did make the bench. For a second, I thought I only saw one of them. So I actually had Victor Wembanyama as my, well, I should say this in better order. I had Anthony Davis as my, second front court spot. So I thought Anthony Davis is the second most deserving all-star in the front court in the Western Conference. So it was Jokic, then AD for me. And then the third spot I gave to Victor Wembanyama. And it was very, very close between him and KD for me. But yeah, the main thing here that I have a problem with is just Anthony Davis, LeBron James making it over Anthony Davis as the Laker all-star, you know, in the starting lineup. To me, that's just like, I don't know what people are watching. I mean, LeBron James, obviously, if he's your second best player, you're sitting pretty good in most scenarios, you know, although the Lakers don't have an awesome team around those two. So it's not like ideal, but still as a top two, you can't really ask for a better pairing, you know, than LeBron James and Anthony Davis. And Anthony Davis is just clearly the best player on the Lakers this year. And I think that's almost like it's been an intentional delegation from LeBron as well. You know, he's like, he knows that, and he's like allowing the team to take form and kind of go through Anthony Davis. And LeBron James is taking a little bit more of a co-star role, which I think is admirable and it's good and everything. But I think that Anthony Davis he's everything to their defense, literally everything to their defense. And then offensively, he's been their best player too. So it's like, what else is there? I know there's other things than just, you know, simplifying it to two halves of the game. I understand that, but I don't know. To me, I just feel like it should be Anthony Davis, and LeBron James gets in there solely based off fan vote, really, I want to say. Or maybe I'm not sure. Let me look at what the results were. I'll have that on screen for you guys to follow along as well. Yeah, LeBron James actually was the second forward spot, and they had Wemby next, but that doesn't have anything to do with actually who makes it in there on the bench. So, like, technically, as we'll see in the East, I think, Victor, who is the first guy off, who's the first guy off in the voting for the starters, he technically could have missed making the bench as well, because it doesn't matter how good you did in the starter voting. It's a whole new voting system with the coaches getting 100% of that vote for choosing the bench. So they could have just not gotten, you know, I just think that's a weird system, but that's the way it works. And then Anthony Davis was the fifth biggest vote getter in total. That's including the fan vote, which is 50% of the vote for starters. The other 50 is split in half between media and players. So in players, AD was fifth. So yeah, that's the other thing that broke the wrong way to me, was the player vote, which I honestly don't even think should be a thing, because none of them take it seriously, or very few of them do. And that ruins the whole, you know, thing when a lot of them vote for just like random people. I think they can vote for themselves even, I want to say. Maybe they can't, and they only vote for like their, you know, old college buddies or current teammates and, you know, stuff like that, basically, a lot of the time. And then, you know, the guys that do get more of the serious votes are just like the name, you know, like LeBron, instead of a guy like AD this year. But that's the way it goes. And so, yeah, fan vote put LeBron at second, and player vote got LeBron at second, but tied rather with KD. I mean, KD had the same exact amount of the player vote. And then in the media, this is where things look a little bit more accurate. Basically exactly the way I had it. LeBron James is ranked fourth, while Kevin Durant is fifth. So I just had them flipped around in that order in my personal ranking. But they actually had Victor second. So Wembanyama is second according to media, which is a little bit higher than I had him. I had him at third, obviously, behind AD. So that's the other thing that didn't break right for AD, was that media put him a little bit lower than I think they should have, on top of the other two categories putting him way lower than they should have, down at five. So yeah, looking back at the actual teams, though, AD is one of the bench guys. Anthony Edwards is the top guard on the bench, which I had as well. James Harden is here on the bench. I did not have James Harden. He was one of the first guys off, though, for sure. Jaren Jackson Jr. made it in here, and I was very happy to see that. I did have him on my team. He was right below LeBron for me. And then Şengün is on here, and I really thought that I would have Şengün on my team, like, before I really mapped it out in my head, and I actually did not. I think I would consider him my first guy off out of all the guys out west. Şengün was the number one guy who didn't make the team for me, but I had Domantas Sabonis in there instead, just because of really Sabonis's numbers this year look insane. And also the Kings on off with him is incredible. Like, the offensive rating with him on is like 126, and with him off is like 111. Like, something like that. It's pretty ridiculous. And then also it's something similar just for offensive defensive rating. I think his defensive rating when he's on is 111 as well. Somewhere in that range, at least. It was that type of split. It was like Jokic type of splits, you know? So I just felt like that really means something, you know, on that Kings team that is pretty middling, for them to have, and all of Sabonis's minutes, really, like, pretty staggering results where they're beating teams by quite a bit. I just think that's a trend that speaks highly of how Sabonis has just kind of dominated this year, scoring a bit more than he ever has at like 21 points a game. And rebounding is the big thing. He's always been one of the best rebounders in the league, but this year he is number one so far at 14.5 boards a game. So rounding to whole numbers, he's at like 21, 15, and 7, I believe. I think he's at like 6.6 assists per contest. So that's why I thought that Sabonis should have been in there instead of Şengün. But, you know, love seeing Şengün in there. I'm obviously the reason why he gets in there over Sabonis is because of the team representation thing. I try to not think about that as much as other people do. I don't not think about it at all. Obviously, I consider winning when I'm picking, you know, who the best basketball players are. But a lot of people like treat it as a criteria of like, if a team is a top four seed or whatever, they have to have at least one all-star, maybe even more than that. Like, I think some people say like the top six seed, you know, got to have an all-star representing them. And then a team that's like the first or second seed has to have two all-stars. You know, I've heard people say stuff like that. And to me, it's just like, why make these predetermined rules? Like, what's the point of being a voter or like being able to discern things and like, you know, compare and contrast different situations? It's like a case by case basis, you know. You can't really do that when you just predetermine set parameters of like, well, if this team has this record, then they have to have two all-stars and there's no other way to go about it. You know, so that was the reason why back several years ago, Bradley Beal, when he was averaging like 31 points a game leading the league in scoring, didn't make it in there because the Raptors had the number one seed in the East. And so they had to give somebody else besides Kawhi a roster spot on the all-star team. Some voters did, at least, you know. And it was enough to shift it into Kyle Lowry's direction, putting Lowry in there over Bradley Beal, which I actually don't hate that as much now, several years later, as I did then. I understand Lowry's impact a little bit more now is not just about, you know, numbers, but still, that was it felt like Bradley Beal was a deserving all-star that year. I'm pretty sure he made All-NBA, I want to say. Pretty sure he ended up All-NBA third team, and he wasn't even an all-star. But anyways, Jalen Williams is one of the other guys here on the bench from the Thunder, and then Victor Wembanyama is the last guy listed down here, at least, on the bench for the Western Conference. Mark Daigneault is the coach of the team, seeing as the OKC Thunder have the best record in the conference. Did they not last year at All-Star break? Who coached the All-Star teams last? Was that Mike Malone? The Nuggets might have had the one seed. I doubt it. We usually start off the season slower, so I don't know. I don't know if we would have had the one seed at All-Star break last year, but I can't think of it. Couldn't have been Daigneault. The reason why I'm talking about this is because that's a weird rule that came into play a couple years ago, where if a coach has been the, I don't even think it's a specific coach, it's just the coach of a team. So if a team has had their head coach be the All-Star coach in a given year, the next year, that team's head coach is ineligible of being the All-Star coach, if that makes sense. It's like Doc Rivers. So it did come in play last year. Doc Rivers was the All-Star coach last year because Joe Mazzulla wasn't allowed to be. He was the head coach of the All-Stars the year prior, and they can't do it in consecutive years. So I feel like Daigneault and the Thunder probably had the best record at All-Star last year, I thought, but he must not have, obviously, if he's the coach this year. So might have been Chris Finch, now that I'm thinking about it. Could have been the Timberwolves as the one seed. I guess I didn't even mention who I had. I mentioned I had Sabonis over Şengün. I did say that. But the other difference I had was Kyrie instead of James Harden. I thought Kyrie Irving deserved a spot here. Just because like the way that he has carried the Mavs in pretty big stretches without Luka this year. Luka's missed so many games. Kyrie's missed a few too, but not near as much as Luka. And did I say Cavs a little bit ago? I'm talking about the Mavericks right now. I feel like I said Cavs. I don't know if I did, but the Mavericks, Kyrie Irving leading them without their star player and Luka Doncic has been, you know, it's been a big effort from him. PJ Washington is another guy that stepped up. They're big guys, and Derek Lively before he got injured, and then Daniel Gafford have also both been pretty big contributors. Najee Marshall was a great add this year as like do all the dirty work defensive guy, hustle guy. So yeah, Clay hasn't worked out super great so far, obviously. I don't know. He might have a little bit of a turnaround here during the season. It wasn't like a terrible signing, I don't think, because they got him at a pretty decent number. But yeah, not living up to the hopes that I think some people had for it. He's not definitely not the guy that can step up. Well, he hasn't been with Luka out. He hasn't been a guy that can step up and kind of fill that former role that he once had, being more of a star. But I think he's kind of moved more into just the off ball, although he's played on ball quite a bit this year too, but more the role player shooter role. But yeah, so there's that. We will look at my teams now, my sub all-star team. I guess first I can show you that the actual team that I had. Yeah, so I did have Kyrie actually as the second guard. So he didn't make the team in real life, but I had him as my second guard on the bench. And then, yeah, in the East, same thing. Well, Trae Young didn't make the team, but he was my last guard, or not even one of my guards. He was my wild card, the last wild card. So the 12th guy on my team. So that's not that big of a discrepancy, I guess. And then Sabonis was also one of my wild cards. So that's also not that insane. But yeah, Kyrie, I think, is that big, the big surprise there, honestly. Getting left off for me, at least. But he hasn't been like the guy that I've heard much talk about being left off. The guys I've heard more talk about being left off has been Sabonis, Trae Young, and LaMelo Ball, which we'll get to. Looking at my actual sub-all-star teams, out West makes sense. All the stuff I've been saying about Kyrie Irving, that is my first guard on the sub-all-star team in the Western Conference. The next guard I have is De'Aaron Fox, who I mentioned a little bit ago in the intro as a guy who is on the trading block because of his situation in Sacramento. I think he's just had kind of one foot out the door the past however long now, since he's not been signing that extension that he's been eligible for, because he wanted to ensure that the Kings would be in a good place. And then the whole Mike Brown situation happened, them firing him. I think that created a little bit of a rift because a lot of people blamed De'Aaron Fox for that, because there was a bit of a, you know, some disagreements between him and Mike Brown. And so people think that the Kings ownership and management made the decision to get rid of Mike Brown to appease De'Aaron Fox, because they want desperately to keep him and they're worried about losing him because he does have a wandering eye. He has openly had a wandering eye the past year or so. I feel like them doing that, firing Mike Brown, might have made it worse to me. Not made them playing worse this season. They actually did. They went on a pretty big tear after they let him go. I don't know if it's completely, totally 100% causation, you know, but there was a correlation there for sure. But yeah, Mike Brown getting fired, I feel like they might have made the De'Aaron Fox situation worse because of what I just laid out, how the people are kind of looking at him, blaming him for that. Maybe some other people in the locker room who were more Mike Brown guys, you know, things like that. I just feel like might be factors at play, or at least could be, you know, just theorizing. I have no idea, but that's what comes to mind at least. And then his Sacramento teammate is who I have is the number one front court spot on my sub all-star team. And that is Domantas Sabonis, the guy that I felt like should have been in a wild card spot on the actual team. Already kind of went into his whole impact for this season. And the next front court spot is a pretty bit of a controversial one, just because of technicalities. I slid Devin Booker down into the front court because there's so many guards. And also, like, I'm not just going to do that with any guard. Like, I wouldn't put Kyrie Irving in the front court. Like, I would never do that, obviously, because it doesn't make any sense. But Devin Booker, I think for, like, I don't know if the majority of the season he has, but last year for sure, the majority of the season, he was starting at the three. And he started several games this year at the three. And the Olympic team, he was, like, playing three most of the time because they usually had two guards out there and then him as the wing. So I don't know. To me, it's just like he's definitely a front court guy. He could be. He plays three all the time. So why can't I put him at the three on an all-star team or a sub-all-star team, you know? So that's the reason I did that. And it just makes the team work a lot better. There's just a lot more deserving backcourt players to me than there are spots for them to fit into, because there's always, you know, two backcourts, three front courts in each of the starting and bench roles, and then also on the main team it's like that too. So it starts stacking up pretty quickly how many front court guys
get taken out of the pool and how many backcourt guys are left in the pool. But yeah, so then same exact logic for this next one that I have in the front court, and that's Luka Doncic. He hasn't played like a ton of games this year, but it's Luka, and he's also not having a great Luka season by his own lofty standards. But I'm pretty sure he's averaging like 28, 8, and 8. So it's kind of hard to not give that guy a sub all-star spot, you know, even though he's played 20 something games. That's still like half the games that his team has played. So maybe even a little bit over half right now. I think he has played in 22, I want to say, total games. So it's something around half. Regardless, I did want to go into a little bit more about Devin Booker's case, and by more I mean at all, because I didn't really explain that at all. I just talked about what position he plays. But Devin Booker, his case for an all-star this year, you know, people were looking at his season so far, especially towards the beginning of the season, as like his worst season in quite a while, which I think it still might be his worst the past few years for sure. But I think ever since we really started honing in and focusing in on all-star voting, like on like who are the all-stars going to be, you know, we started doing this probably about a month and a half ago, I'd say. Ever since then, I think Booker has gotten a lot better. Like he's improved. His numbers have improved quite a bit, kind of gone back up to the norm for him. And he's still dishing it out like crazy though. He's averaging like 7 assists a game. Been basically, you know, in a lot of ways, he's their point guard, even though they do have Tyus Jones running things there now. I just feel like Devin Booker has been big for them, doing role player stuff as well, playing defense, being an off ball spacer, you know, all those things, while Bradley Beal or somebody else, Kevin Durant, you know, is the one working in isolation or running in action, you know, with a two man game, something like that. But yeah, that's why I feel like Devin Booker deserves to be. I kind of said his name is Booger. I don't want to do that. That sounded weird. Devin Booker. That's why I felt like he deserved to be in here. I just think that he's better than some people I feel like have painted him to be this year. And he was definitely a worthy, like, actual all-star consideration for me. Obviously, since I have him in here as the fourth name on the list, you know, the second front court spot. And if he was a guard, I might have him over Fox in the backcourt as my second guard. Maybe he'd be around that same level. But yeah, Luka is the other guy, and I did already kind of mention his case. Ja Morant is who I have as the first guard in the backcourt. I've seen a lot of people who had Ja on their actual all-star team, and especially the people that were putting him on there and Jaren Jackson not on there was where I had the main issue. It's like Jaren Jackson Jr., kind of what I said about AD earlier, like he's been their best player on defense clearly, but he's also been their best offensive player. Like I heard some people freak out when somebody said that on the show that I was listening to, and the other, like everybody else on the show all like reacted that as if that was like a crazy thing to say, that Jaren Jackson Jr. has been the best offensive player for the Grizzlies this season. And then even the person who said it kind of backed off and was like rephrased it as most consistent. But I don't even think you need to really say it like that. I think he's just been their best offensive player, to be honest. Like, or at least it's not like an insane thing to say that. I don't think it's an insane thing to say that Ja Morant per possession, you know, has been their best offensive player. But I don't even think, even if you're viewing it that way, that it's that crazy to pick Jaren Jackson Jr. with how much more scoring he's done and how much more efficient he's been than Ja Morant. But then you get into choosing between a playmaker and a scorer, and that's like just a different conversation, I think, than saying that Jaren Jackson Jr., on top of just being the most, like, the best defensive player on their team by far, he's been, like, not unarguably, but not, it's still within bounds completely to say that he's been their best offensive player. And I would even say that's probably more correct than it is incorrect, you know, especially when you factor in the consistency part. So yeah, that's why I felt like people putting in Ja Morant over Jaren Jackson Jr. was a bit wild, but I do think that he deserves to be here in the backcourt. He hasn't played a ton of games. That's another thing that brings him down for me, and puts him down here instead of up in, you know, the top of this sub-all-star team. But while he's been playing, I do understand like the argument that some people have made for why he should be an all-star, even though he hasn't played a ton and his efficiency has been down and everything. Like, he's one of the most captivating players in the league to watch. Like, every night he plays, he does something that you've never seen before, you know, with his just crazy athleticism and also really high IQ playmaker and everything. Like, I understand that part of it. And it's like the soul of what all-star is like to just put on an entertaining show. I understand that for sure, I guess, but I feel like I can use that type of mindset when I'm doing like a tiebreaker, when I have two players that I feel like are pretty even for me when I'm talking about just their, how good they are as basketball players, how much they deserve to be in an all NBA type of team for their season of work. That's when I can differentiate between two guys that I feel like are dead even in that department. I can then think about, well, who's the more showy, flashy, like who's more of the all-star player, you know, that I feel like would just make a better all-star. That's where I feel like it's fine to whip out that card. I don't know if I would do it to be like a whole category of like what qualifies you, you know, like then, I don't know, to me, that's just a different thing. But I guess I understand other people having a different view on that than me for sure. But CJ McCollum is the next guard that I have to continue down this list as the second guard in the backcourt on the bench. And he, the reason why I feel like he should be in here, because I feel like this is probably a curveball pick for me. I'm not sure exactly. I haven't looked at like a bunch of people making their teams, but from the voting at least, not a lot of people agreed with me. It looked like, yeah, where I can't even find him. Where is he? Yeah, he's all the way down here. So this is, I don't know. I'll cut it out, but 23rd guard. He was the 23rd guard in voting for the starters, at least. So, you know, I don't know if he would make it for a lot of people on the sub-all-star team, especially as high as I have him. But I don't know. To me, most of these guys above him, really, is just like, I don't know. He's more deserving all-star to me just because of, even though, yes, the Pelicans have been terrible, he has been like the only reason that they've won the few games that they did when they were missing all of their other guys. Like, he was the captain of the G League Pelicans for a while, basically, you know, that they were rolling out. It was all just completely different people every night, no NBA experience, or just like people they pulled off the couch. Like, Elfrid Payton came out there and did he get... What did he have? I want to make sure this is real and this wasn't a fever dream. He had like 17 assists or something like that, like something insane. Yeah, they brought him in for seven. So I think he was on like a 10-day contract that they might have renewed. He was on there for like 20 days or something because he played seven games. He started three of them. But one of the games, he did something incredible. Yeah, no, I undersold him. He had 21 assists in a game. This year that he just was like, he wasn't doing anything. And then they brought him in to play point guard for them. That's insane to me. He didn't play that all that bad, but he was given just the keys to it because they were like, we don't have, everybody's injured right now. Everyone. So could you want to come play for our team? Like 35 minutes a game for like a couple weeks. So that's got to be the first time that's ever happened. Somebody's had 21 assists in a game, and then like a week later, he's not on an NBA team. He had 21 assists in an NBA sanctioned game, and then like a week later, he's not on a team. That's just wild to me. But anyways, so he is not one of our sub all stars. Did not play enough games, only seven. But CJ McCollum though. Is averaging like 22 points a game, a bit of a facilitator as well. Honestly, pretty efficient as well for like the amount of load that was on him and like just absolutely no other threats on the team with him at the same time. How much he was able to keep his efficiency has been impressive. And he's played a lot of the games. So I just feel like he deserves to be in here because he's the only reason the Pelicans were still an NBA team this year. You know, they were still categorically an NBA team because they had CJ McCollum. And then Norman Powell is a guy that I put as my first front court spot here in the West. Even though obviously he is, I think a lot of people would lean more as a guard. I think this is the least defensible, not defensible, but the most kind of me taking my liberties, you know, a little bit too far, and swapping in somebody to the front court. I think the other two, or the other three rather, make more sense with Devin Booker, Zach LaVine, and Luka Doncic. I don't even think I mentioned the Zach LaVine one. I was saying that like I mentioned it, but we'll get to that later. Out east. But rather the Norman Powell one, I just feel like, you know, he's played a lot of three. He used to be listed as a three when he was in Portland. And I think I might be overselling actually how much different this is than the other ones, just because of how short he is. Like, he's shorter than all these other guys. But I'm pretty sure he starts at three for the Clippers. At least he has for a lot of stretches, because they've had definitely several games where they start Chris Dunn as the point guard. And then they have, I guess, James Harden or Norm Powell would be considered the three. But I opted to go with Norm Powell, since obviously James Harden is on the actual team, not even here. So yeah, Norm Powell, I put as a three in the front court to fit more guards onto the team. He has been a flamethrower. I think he's clearly the most improved player this season so far. It would be crazy if he doesn't win that award, to be honest, from what we've seen so far, because of just, and his age 31 season, taking that big of a leap in production is insane. He's averaging a little bit more minutes, I think, but not like an insane amount. Like, he was getting starter level minutes last season, but he was in more of a role player lane, you know, with Paul George and sometimes Kawhi Leonard out there. He was averaging like 12 points a game, I want to say, something around there, 12 or 13 last season. And this season he's averaging 23, 24. So, you know, literally like a 10 point per game jump at age 31 is, I think, unheard of, honestly. I don't think that's ever happened before, especially when it's not like just a down season that he had. Like, it's kind of just where he's been for most of his career, was down there, and then all of a sudden he's up here. So, and doing it on a good team, mind you, is the other huge thing about this. Like, it's different than like a New Orleans, you know, losing all of their players and then, you know, rolling Elfrid Payton out there to get 21 assists. You know, it's not the same thing as what Norman Powell's doing, because Norman Powell's doing it on a team that has been a winning team this season. And for a while, we're like the four seed. I think they're like the fifth or sixth right now, I want to say, off the top of my head. Yeah, they are the sixth seed, just a half game behind the Lakers at five. And they've been a really good defensive team. And then their offense has just been like James Harden be the primary engine playmaker and then Norm Powell be the bucket getter. And that would be enough for us to, you know, get by beating teams with our defense. And so that's really been the Clippers formula this season, to be honest. And so I think that deserves some recognition for sure, getting him on my sub all-star team. And then the next front court spot is another guy on that same team that has been huge for them this season, not just physically, but like, because he's also been that for sure. This is Ivica Zubac that I'm referring to, the starting center on the Clippers, hailing from Croatia, I believe. I think he was one of the ones that was born in a different country than where he actually, what he considers his nationality or whatever. Pretty sure he's Croatian, but was born in Bosnia, I think. But yeah, anyways, Ivica Zubac. He's averaging like 15 and 13 or something like that, like 15 points, 13 rebounds, doing it really efficiently as well as the main role man in the James Harden pick and roll duo. His free throws are way down this year, I noticed, down in percentage at least. I'm not sure about in rate. Yeah, he is averaging 15 and 13. Also, not too shabby, three assists. His playmaking has jumped a lot. Let me look if that holds up in per 100, because he is probably playing more than usual. And yes, it does. This is actually his highest assist season in per possession basis as well. And then, yeah, free throw rate actually is about the same as where it used to be, but the percentage, though, is by far his lowest season. And it's actually a little bit better than the last time I looked, because I feel like, I think the last time I looked, it was at like 55%. Right now, it's just under 59%. And he's usually, I always think of Zubac as a mid-70s free throw shooter. He actually has been a little bit below that the past three seasons. But it's, you know, 73% to 70% and 72% down to 59% this year. But the year before, the first year I just said, he was all the way up at 79%. He did have the half a season with the Lakers
33 games where he had a percentage of 86. So yeah, don't know what that's about. Him shooting so much lower with his free throws all of a sudden. Maybe he's just exerting a lot more energy doing other things, and then the free throw line is like a break for him. So yeah, I just felt like Zoo deserved a shout out there. Got my second front court spot. Onto the third one, the last front court spot on the bench. That is Julius Randle, which I know a lot of people would be like, why are you putting, you know, he's had just such a rough season. Timberwolves fans really don't seem to like him all that much here in his new team in Minnesota. A terrible fit. I hated the trade ever since it was made. I never thought that this would be good for Randle or the Wolves, but there's no denying his role on the Wolves. You know, even though they've been disappointing, they're still like a around 500 team. I think a little bit above 500, I want to say. Oh yeah, they must have been going on a little bit of a tear lately, because they're 27-21 now. I remember recently they were like literally 500. But yeah, Randle's averaging 19-7-5 for the Wolves this year. Played 48 games. And he's just kind of one of their main hubs on the team. So I just feel like it ranks a little bit higher than some of the more ancillary guys that I was considering to put on there instead of him. Mainly Andrew Wiggins and Michael Porter Jr. I just felt like it's, even though they've played better in their like smaller roles this season, I just feel like Julius Randle's had the tougher task, you know, fitting into this weird situation for him. So I decided to give Randle that spot. The next guy I have, and so this is the wild cards, I have Jamal Murray and Austin Reeves to finish out my roster in the West. Jamal, you know, famously has not made an all-star team in his career, because no, Jokic has not played with anybody who's made an all-star team, all-NBA, or all-defense even in his entire career. Never once. Even before he was, you know, an all-star himself, he still never played with anybody who's done any of those things, at least at the time, you know, while he was playing with them, because he did play with Paul Millsap, who used to be an all-star back in the day. But, you know, it was after his peak that he came to Denver. And he was no longer, you know, the best player on his team type of player. But anyways, yeah, Jamal Murray, I think he made the first ever Hoop Theory sub all-star team. So that's something he can, you know, he can put on his shelf. I know that he'll probably make an all-star team at one point, I think, unless his just weird regular season abysmal stretches continue to happen every single year, which it kind of feels like it is at this point, but who knows? We'll see. He is that level play. Like when he's on, he's just on. And sometimes he's just one of the most confusing players I've ever watched. Like in that way that he can be so bad. And then when he's making his shots, it's like a whole different thing. And he's like better on defense then. And you know, it's just, all these things just look so much better when he's just making his shots. And he's more in rhythm. Also, when he's just feeling more healthy, like he's moving better, is a big thing, because then he can get more separation from people and makes his shots easier and all that kind of stuff. So he's looking more like that recently, for sure. Just last game, Jamal, I believe that was last game, one of the most recent games, Jamal actually had clearly a better game than Jokic. I think that's like the first time in a long time that's happened. Other than maybe that of the 46 ball that he had. Although Jokic was really good that game as well. He was just kind of minimized because Jamal was playing so well, like shooting so well, that he kept delegating. This other game that I'm talking about, Jokic had a pretty poor game, probably his worst game of the season, honestly. And then Jamal went off. He had a really good Jamal game, probably his second best game of the season. So and did come in a loss. So it wasn't, you know, it would have been better if we would have had a normal Jokic game and then a great Jamal game for a change. But that is the way that went. But yeah, anyways, Jamal is my first wildcard spot. Austin Reeves is the other one, just being the, you know, primary ball handler, really, outside of LeBron. I don't know. I'm sure LeBron's probably still carried more of the load, but Austin Reeves is pretty close to the amount of like usage in terms of ball handling, passing, and creating shots, playing pick and roll with AD. Austin Reeves has been doing all that this year. And then when he's not doing that, he is off the ball as like a 3-and-D wing, 3-and-D small guard. Although it's weird for me to say the D in there, because, you know, he is kind of at least famously kind of a target on defense, but
that's one thing I think people misunderstand about Austin Reaves is like, yes, he's a target on defense for bigs, like specifically. That's like whenever people are hunting him on defense, it's always when they have like a big man. So like in the not Olympics, FIBA a couple years ago over in the Philippines, we were facing off against Montenegro who had Vucevic. And so they kept trying to get switches to get Austin Reaves guarding Vucevic and post up Vucevic on Austin Reaves. A lot of teams kind of go to that in the NBA also in their stretches where it's like, Austin Reaves out here, let's focus on him, get him switch onto a big because he's just small. You know, a lot of players that are smaller get that type of thing, especially when they also have kind of a slight build, like he's not super strong. But in terms of guarding guards, Austin Reaves holds up just fine. Like he does his job, you know, so I will point that out. He's not just like a complete defensive zero, like some people talk about him. But yeah, and then the guys who were just off my West team were Jalen Green, Andrew Wiggins, and Michael Porter Jr. were the three guys I was kind of like debating putting in there over some of the other guys. But yeah, I won't go too deep into them. I'll just move on to the Eastern Conference. Trae Young is who I have as the number one guard in the backcourt. LaMelo Ball is the other one. And see, this is, I think, a lot of people's problem with who made the All-Star team. Like Jacob, actually, co-host of the show, texted me last night after he first saw who got on the team. And he was like, I think he said LaMelo or Garland over LaMelo is insane. And, you know, Garland, I'm a lot higher on, obviously. I had him as my top guard on the bench, literally my third guard in the East. But I understand a lot of people want to put LaMelo in there over like Tyler Hero or something like that, because he's averaging like 28, 5, and 7. He's only played 31 games, I'm seeing now. So he hasn't played like a ton. It's definitely enough to make it on there for me. But like he gets a little bit of a tick down compared to the people who are playing over 40. But yeah, the thing with me is his efficiency is just not anywhere near what you would like obviously want. He obviously plays for a terrible team that doesn't have a lot going outside of him. So it makes sense that he just kind of has to create things out of thin air. And it's not always the most efficient way to produce offense, but it is in, you know, the situation he's in where there's just not a lot of other options. But, you know, field goal percentage is actually a little bit better than it was recently when I looked. But he's at 42% from the field, 34%, a little under that from three. Shooting, wow, this has gone way down. Last time I looked at this, it was at 13.0 3-point attempts per game. He's at 12.3 now. So he must have, past few games, just not taken near as many threes. But for a while there, he was just basically, his shot chart was like, his average length of shot was something like 25 feet, or maybe more than that, like 26 feet. It was something like a couple feet behind the 3-point line was his average shot attempt length. Because of how many half court shots, basically, like when he pulls up from like the logo, it's like, yeah, he makes like more than you would think of that. But there's a reason why his 3-point percentage is only 34%. You know, that's like, it's just not ideal. It's a below average offense. If you're doing that every possession, you're scoring like 108, something like that, points per 100. And that's definitely below like where kind of like 120 is kind of like the sweet spot. That's ideal. Most things aren't 120. Most things are more like 115. League average is like 114, 113, somewhere in there is like the league average offensive possession. So yeah, he's definitely a little bit below that with taking those threes, but it's still impressive to be in the ballpark of like acceptably efficient. You know what I mean? Doing that. So I understand that part of it. But the other thing that kind of counts against LaMelo for me is like in games where the team is trying to win, like there's been a couple of games where Charles Lee just doesn't close with LaMelo. Like he doesn't even bring him in crunch time when a game's close, because he, like the coach thinks that they have a better chance of winning if LaMelo's not on the court. Which I think just should say a lot about, or like, you know, just basketball in general. I get LaMelo Ball is one of the most famous players on the planet. Kids love him. He's like the most popular player with kids. And he does insane things. Like he has the most creativity of any passer in the world right now, probably. And that's even saying like over Luka and Jokic, maybe. Like he's more flashy pass thrower, honestly, than those guys. But like so much of his game is about those things instead of just making functionally the right play sometimes, which I understand. Like it's at the end of the day, sometimes some people, they like sports because they're fun, you know, basketball, when it's played the way LaMelo plays it, is just like pure fun. And I get the appeal of that for sure. And in some ways, in some situations, like it's better than being like an average team. Like if LaMelo played just like functionally, you know, basketball, pure ethical hoops, like just makes the right play all the time, you know, just changes his whole game and plays exactly the way, like traditionally, why we're like making the right play. How good are the Hornets? You know, they're not like insane. They're better than what they are right now, which is like the second worst team in the East. But they're also not going to be like making the playoffs above the play-in. Like they're going to be at max, like the 7 or 8 seed at max. So like, you know, there's definitely an argument to be made there. Like, would you rather be a mediocre team or a team that, yeah, you don't win very much, but you, it's really fun to watch your star player. And he fills the seats and he has, you know, he makes a big impact on the culture of basketball, you know? So I understand that. And so for those reasons, I could see somebody sliding LaMelo in on the all-star team instead of Tyler Hero or Trae Young in the case of how I had my all-star team made. So yeah, that makes sense to me. But those are some of the reasons why I feel like there's two different ways to look at, I guess, LaMelo in his case to me. But Trae Young is the first guard I had on here. Like I said, he's having his lowest scoring season in a long time. And that's because he's like accepted a role that I honestly didn't think Trae Young would ever accept. Like kind of what I was just saying about LaMelo Ball. Like he did what I was just kind of making the comparison of like, what if LaMelo Ball was the most ethical hooper who made all the right plays all the time? Trae Young kind of did that this season to himself. Like he was like, I need to be better at playing off the ball and delegating more and like allowing the ball to move and throughout the offense and not being just a black hole on offense who only shoots or assists on like every single play, you know, like I've got to be able to orchestrate things in other ways and be helpful and useful without the ball in my hands and also lock in on the defensive end to really improve there. Like he's done all of those things and like his numbers aren't quite as eye popping, although he is leading the league in assists at like 11.5 a game. Which definitely is eye popping, but you know, his scoring numbers are way down. At one point there were, it was like 20.5 points a game. I think it's climbed up a little bit to just under 23 now, but still, yeah, like that's why I feel like Trae Young, I'm taking him more seriously as like making an impact on winning than I used to. He used to have a little bit of the LaMelo Ball syndrome with just taking half court shots and making crazy passes. So yeah, there's kind of a similar trajectory I see there that I just kind of made the connection of now. But Zach LaVine is the first front court spot. He's another guy that I slid out of position to put down there. And I think about the Bulls might list him as their starting small forward, to be honest. It's, you can quibble about who technically you think should be the three, and there's not really a right answer because there's no like official listing of it, I don't think. I think several other outlets, like they have different orders of the starting lineups, like who, where they put people at each position. But Zach LaVine is out there with Josh Giddey, who a lot of people would call Josh Giddey the point guard on the Bulls because in the offense, he functionally serves as the point guard, as the primary ball handler, distributor, all that stuff. So if you're putting Josh Giddey as the point guard, Coby White is definitely the two guard. Coby White's not the three. The three would be Zach LaVine because he would be guarding the bigger players and plays more of the off ball, like getting set up type of role instead of like the primary ball handler, while Coby White's more of the combo guard. But, you know, I could see somebody saying Coby White is the point guard because he's guarding the point guards, you know, and Zach LaVine being the two. And then that would make Josh Giddey the three. That's like kind of like a point forward. So there's different ways to look at and define it. But that's why I think that Zach LaVine is okay to slot in there at the three. Jalen Johnson is who I have at the next front court spot in the starters for the East. I heard somebody say that when they were like debating who should be on the actual all-star team, and they were talking about Jalen Johnson, saying that his numbers aren't eye-popping. But to me, it's like, yeah, maybe not for if it was like LeBron James that we're talking about. But this is a guy that, I don't know, to me, it's like so impressive because where did he come from? Like, I know he went to Duke, obviously. I know that he was like the, or no, he wasn't a lottery pick. He was the 20th, actually. But I think he slid quite a bit because he was a pretty high recruit in high school. Yeah, he was the 11th guy in high school. But he didn't have a great year at Duke. And then also there's kind of questions of he kind of seemed like he could be like a Jeff Green or you know, one of those big wings. Jonathan Kuminga kind of got these comparisons too. Michael Beasley is another one, like big scoring wings. They have like good potential, but they might also be just like kind of a black hole bust type of player. Like Jeff Green was expected to be a lot more than the role player he ended up being in his career. And so people kind of viewed Jalen Johnson in that similar type of way, but he's gone the other direction. At one point he was averaging 20 points a game this season, but right now he's at 19, 10 and 5 as a fourth year guy. Who was the 20, like, it just, I don't know why, to me, it's so surreal that he's this good. He wasn't one of my guys, really, in the draft, and whenever that happens, I'm just really surprised by it, I think. But yeah, 19, 10, and 5, the way that he's good at everything is insane. He doesn't shoot all that well at just 31%, but free throws aren't terrible. They're actually pretty good. 75% for a guy who's not, like, you know, a shooter. But yeah, 19, 10, and 5. Distributing the ball, stealing the ball, 1.6 per game, and then also one block a game as well. So yeah, he's just kind of a force. He's like one of those guys that I really like in the as a small ball center in this kind of new era. You know, there's a lot of guys that coaches have tried to fit into the small ball center role, like a Ben Simmons, like, you know, several other players. And some of them, like Michael Porter Jr. is a guy that sometimes when he plays down, like he tries to play a bigger position. It doesn't work out all that well. Like he's just not as physical, this and that. And Jalen Johnson is one of those guys that goes the opposite direction. You know, like he's a big wing. Naturally, he's like a three, you know, like a big three. But functionally, like he can guard the fours and fives just fine. Like he's very physical and just has an imposing size and presence down there in the paint. So yeah, so I just want to make that shout out to Jalen Johnson quick. But yeah, and then the last front court spot in the East I have is Jarrett Allen. He kind of with the Sabonis thing I was saying, Jarrett Allen is the most aggressive version of that that I've came across while researching for All-Stars. Obviously, the other three stars on his team all made the actual All-Star team because Cleveland has been having such an insane season. And Jarrett Allen, obviously, I'm not putting him over any of those other guys, but I just think he's closer to them than some people might think in total impact because comparatively right now he's having the best offensive rating of all time. For those who are watching video, I'm here on his basketball reference in the per 100 table. It says gold career totals indicate an all-time career record. So he has the all-time career record offensive rating. This is something that I just came across while I was like researching for All-Stars, that his career offensive rating is the best in NBA history. Off like Jarrett Allen, like it's just insane to me. Like a defensive big, a guy who's considered, and his defensive rating on his career is 108, which is also insane. I guess this is something that's, it's not just this year, but it's a thing that's been his story of his entire career. It's just crazy to me that Jarrett Allen, a defensive center, you know, like purely you think of him, you don't really think of him for his offense at all. You think of him as a rim protector. And on offense, he's just a roll man. He doesn't shoot. He's very efficient because he's just rolls the rim. All the shots come right at the basket. But his offensive rating is 130. That's just incredible to me. But this year it's even more drastic than it ever has been. He's leading the league in offensive rating this season at 143. 143. I don't know how that's not a record. I guess it wouldn't tell us if it is based off this, because the gold thing only is for career totals. So if this was the best season ever, it would still just be bold. It's bold right now because that means it's the best this season. It's the best offensive rating in the NBA this year. But it wouldn't, if it was the best of all time, we wouldn't be able to know just based off looking at this table. So it might be. I'm not sure. I've never seen that as an offensive rating before. But 108 defensive rating as well this year. So that's quick math, a 25 points per 100 possessions difference. So that's a plus 25 net. That's not even true. 30, it's 35. I was about to say 25 is a lot, but it's not like it's 35. So the Cavs, when Jared Allen is on the floor for them this season, are beating teams by 35 points per 100. Obviously, these numbers don't mean absolutely everything, and that's why, like, if they did, he would be the number one, he would be like the MVP, maybe. Like, he would be in debate with Jokic for MVP this season. But yeah, it's definitely still something, though. Like, you don't just not look at that or consider that when you're talking about, you know, who's the best in a given conference this season, you know. That type of stuff definitely matters, at least a little bit. So that is a big reason why he's gotten on here for me. But, you know, also when you look at just his counting stats impact, there's definitely some stuff there. At 14 points, 10 rebounds, 2 assists, efficient, like I said before, just under 71% from the field. Again, you know, all of his shots come right at the rim. He's only taking 8 shots a game. Shooting his free throws pretty well, 73%. His blocks are pretty down this season, actually, at 0.9. It's the first time he's been under a block per game his whole career. But also, Evan Mobley is getting a lot of those blocks as well for the Cavs this season as more of the roamer. And Jared Allen is more just like strictly the center guarding the big guy on the court in the post. So usually you don't get a ton of blocks when you're guarding people on ball. It's usually the roamer who comes over to help. But yeah, so that is what gets Jared Allen as the starting center on the East sub all-star team for me. And we've got Tyrese Maxey as the first backcourt player off the bench. Sixers have been a dumpster fire this season, and Maxey has been one of the few bright spots. Not having a super efficient season, but kind of like what I've said before with LaMelo Ball, you know, like there's reasons why when your team's playing that poorly that you have to just kind of shot chuck sometimes to get things going. Tyrese Haliburton is the other guard I have in the backcourt. Pacers have really turned it around after a slow start this season. His scoring numbers aren't as high as they look like they would be, like last season for a big stretch, where it looked like he was like one of the new faces of like the East, you know, in terms of like one of the best players out there. Now he's definitely regressed to more of like a really good second best player on a team type of thing, but, you know, still dishing it out as well, averaging like 9 assists a game. Scoring is at 18 points per game. I don't know if I actually said that, but that is where he's at. Shooting pretty well, just under 40%, I believe, from three. And yeah, like I said, Pacers have turned it around a little bit. Bam Adebayo is the first front court spot for me. Bam this season on offense has been pretty disappointing, has not stepped up and filled that role of like the best player on the team like a lot of people thought he would. Tyler Hero has done that as like the, not in terms of like best player overall necessarily, but the primary ball handler, like first option. Tyler Hero has filled that role, and Bam Adebayo has not even really been that good of a second option, to be honest. He's really regressed, I feel like, in that department. But defensively, he's still been really good, and is a big part of the reason why this team has played well this season. You know, that's why I put him there. Franz Wagner is the other front court spot, or the second front court spot for me off the bench. And this guy is like the one of the main cases of if he just played more games, like he would be definitely an all-star for sure for me. In the games that he's played, which I believe are 28, he's averaging 25, 5, and 6. And doing it on a team that was like without their actual best player, Paolo Banchero, having Franz in there as the lone star basically for the team, they were still winning so many games. Like, not, I shouldn't even say still, because actually they didn't win a very good percentage of those 5 games that Paolo played at the start of the season. They started off a little bit slow. Paolo went out, and not necessarily because Paolo went out that the Magic started winning games, but they just, you know, so happened to start winning games. But also it was when Franz Wagner was their, the engine of their team. Franz Wagner took a huge step up filling that role, and he looked insane doing that. So like, there's definitely something there. When they're both back healthy, they'll have a little bit of a dueling fiddle. So it's exciting to see how that will be integrated together, you know, with this team. Magic are one of my favorite teams to watch out East, one of the most intriguing teams to me overall. And Franz Wagner is a big reason why. And then OG Anunoby is the last front court spot I have off the bench in the East. Just playing really well, you know, defensively, scoring the ball as well as like the third or fourth option for the Knicks this season. Probably fourth option behind Mikal Bridges. But he was the third option early on when Mikal came off to a slow start. And then Josh Hart is my first wild card off the Knicks as well. I believe he's averaging 14, 10, and 5, 10, and 6 maybe, something like that. I think it was crazier than it is currently. Yeah, 14, 10, and 6 14-10-6 is what he's averaging. Josh Hart is doing that, which is just insane to me. This Knicks team has been, I really like them, even though their defense has fallen off quite a bit, down to like the middle of the pack. They've been a little bit above average. Before, you know, they were looked at as like, that was like their calling card was defense. Now it's offense, ever since they got Cat. And Josh Hart has been a big reason for their success on both ends. And also, he's literally 6'4", averaging 10 rebounds a game. That is just unbelievable. So just, I thought that alone, honestly, should give him a little bit of a nod here. Then Paolo Banchero is the last guy I have here on the wild cards. Similar thing with Franz. He's played more than just those five games now, obviously, because he came back a couple weeks ago. I believe it's around 20 games played now, I want to say, in that range at least. So that was enough for me, especially with how hot he started off early on, had a 50 ball right at the beginning of the season. His rapid ascension is also fun to watch, and I just think that that deserved him a spot here in the sub-all-star team for me. And then the East, first off, guys, I have a lot more than in the West because it was just a lot closer once we got down here to the bottom of the sub-all-star team. There was more guys on the horizon that I felt like, you know, you could make a case for. And those included Nikola Vucevic, Derek White, Jordan Poole, Scotty Barnes, Cam Johnson, and Brandon Miller. And so that rounds out my sub-all-star teams. I thought this exercise was pretty fun. I think I'm going to probably bring it back, do it every year as like a reoccurring hoop theory tradition. So be looking forward to that. Maybe some year I'll do it with Jacob, hopefully. But yeah, thank you for listening. Stay happy, stay healthy. I, or maybe we, will both talk to you next episode. We'll see what happens.